This is a Gathering Heritage project interview recorded in County Louth in Ireland.
Now, it is payback time. And why I say that, this gentleman that I'm going to interview, I never knew he even existed until about 15 years ago. And how I even said hello to him was, I had an interview with Gerry Adams down in the Sinn Féin office, and I was waiting on him to come, and there was this man that was there walking away at a laptop and his computer, and a very serious looking altogether. And Gerry Adams was late, and I started talking to this man, and now 15 years later, we have gone through the mill in a big way. Jason McGee, Jason, it's always I never knew you, but by God, I know you now.
You do, Harry. Hello, and good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Now, we're going to talk about Jason. Jason's a very private kind of a man. He mouths an awful lot out of him, but behind it all, he's a very quiet, reserved kind of a man. But would I describe you properly, Jason, saying that about you?
Yeah, my mother always... my mother kind of described me one day as being kind of secretive, and it stuck with me. Say, oh my God of Almighty, I'd never expected my mother to call me secretive. But I'm very self-sufficient, Harry, which means I can be private, and I can not often ask for help, which comes across as somebody who's kind of...
And no one knows that better than me.
Yeah. True. And my good lady wife, Kim. But yeah, I am very self-sufficient, you know. I'm able to look after myself. I was taught that way and brought up that way, and it probably comes across as being private, but it's not.
Right, well, let's go back to that point you were just after making. You were brought up that way.
Yeah.
Where were you born, and in what year were you born?
Okay, I was born in 1972, in August of 1972, in the Louth Hospital on a Sunday at 1:30 in the morning. I distinctly remember asking my mum a few times about that, you know, where was he born and when and what was the circumstances. And it was a Sunday. And back in those days, Harry, I didn't find this out for years and years later. The fathers weren't allowed in the delivery rooms with the mothers. Seems such an antiquated thing. You know, I've been to the delivery of two of my beautiful children, and it's such an important thing in life. But yeah, I arrived in, bounced in. I was a very small baby. I was only 5.5 pounds. I remember my mother saying that my grandmother said, "So Jesus, that child is no arse." And I was a very small baby. I was in an incubator for a while, but came along strong after that.
Jason, you had a throwaway line there that you can't understand why men didn't go in, husbands and didn't go in. At that time, Jason, that was an impossible... You wouldn't see... A man didn't want to see what was happening.
Well, having been through it twice, I'm not sure if I wanted to see what happened.
But I mean that in a very serious way. Mm. Men didn't want to go next. I was never... two or three of them, I had five kids,
yeah,
and I never was in the... I was in the hospital once.
Right.
I was sitting at home waiting to ring up the hospital.
Right.
And that's the way it was back in them days.
Seems like an odd thing.
But yeah. But where did you live?
Well, it's an interesting story considering that I'm living in Blackrock now. The very first place that we lived was in a railway carriage on Sandy Lane in Blackrock, where the Neptune pub is now, immediately at the back of that, where the beer garden is, just over the back wall. That was a sandy area on Sandy Lane, and there were two or three railway carriages there.
People used to rent them for the
summer. People used
to
rent it out. And funny enough, the man who rented it out to my folks, I met him with my parents 2 weeks ago in Blackrock. We were socially distancing at the wall, and a man walked past, and my mother said, "There's the fella who used to rent out the caravans to us." And she made a point of going back up and stopping him and talking to him. And when she came back down, she says, "I told him he was a terribly decent man, because when we were starting out in life, we hadn't much money. That's why we were living in a railway carriage. and he never charged us rent. And I says, "Mom, what?" He says, "Yeah, we used to give him the money, but before he left, he used to give us the money back and say, buy the child toys or clothes or whatever."
So, a decent landlord?
A decent, decent yeah. landlord.
So you moved to where then?
Well, the family moved then to Cox's. My mother and father obviously wanted to get a house to put their name down on the housing list, as everybody did, Harry, back in them days. So Ashling Park, I think it was 525 or 575 Ashling Park, was only being built. So this was probably, like, I have early memories of it when I was about four-ish. We might have moved there before then, but it was like they were still building it when we moved in. So it was a brand spanking new house in Ashling Park. You know, I actually drove down there about a year ago to have a look around it, and it hasn't changed that much in 35, 40 years. And that's where we grew up, close to the Redeemer School, close to the community centre. And yeah, when we moved in there, there were lots and lots of kids my age, lots of families starting off. And that was our first home.
Because same thing kind of happened to me. My first house was in Oakland Park, right, which were built just before.
Yeah, they were,
So at that time, it was wonderful. The only thing they did was build too many houses in it.
Well, they did. That type of social housing building is not being done anymore, although there are calls to go back to some kind of model for social housing building. But putting that many people into a place like that caused its own problems.
Now, that we're not going to go into that'll end up in politics and that. And Jason, how would you describe yourself? Were you a good sports chap at school? Were you quiet? And what kind of sport did you play, if you did play?
Yeah, sport, I think, was a very big thing in my life. It has been right up until, you know, I was playing football.
Were you any good?
I'll tell you what I was, Harry. I was a club man. I wasn't brilliant at anything. Although, you know, I played rugby later on in life. But, like, my parents, I suppose everybody did. Like, the parents pushed the kids out the door to say, go out now and play football there. You know, go out all day. And I did. I played football on the street with loads of kids. It was totally different now. I've explained it to my kids. You know, you go out the door at 9 o'clock in the morning, Harry. You come home at 1 o'clock for your dinner. You go back out again. You wouldn't be seen until sundown. And we just played football all the time. So at school, when I initially went to the Redeemer School was very big on soccer, very big on Gaelic. And I have very good memories of playing sports outdoor in the Redeemer School. Basketball, I was quite good at basketball. I actually was quite good at everything, but I wasn't brilliant. But I was one of those people you could rely on. I turned up, I was there. You know, I didn't cry off at an injury. And I just was one of those, you know, club men that you could rely on, that always played a bit of sport.
And had you got any other talent? Could you play music?
No, to my mother's lament, she wanted me to play accordion in the Redeemer School, and there was a band, and they had an accordion band. Tried it, and I was absolutely crap. And my parents had bought me an accordion. You know, it was a big purchase, I suppose. And I tried it, and I was rubbish at it, and I couldn't. I didn't do that. So I can't. Looking back, I don't remember, you know, having a pastime other than sports. But I remember later on in life, Harry, particularly when I was in my teens, heading into my 20s, I was playing four different sports in a week. And, you know, my kit bag was just constantly wet or dirty. And my mother and father didn't know, where is he today? Is he playing rugby or soccer or what is he at? But they knew that I was happy and I was, you know, making friends. And I'd say those friends stay with you for the rest of your life. That's the big thing about sport, yeah, is that you can make some...
Well, you were obviously, if you're a very, very talented soccer player, you're in an elite kind of thing.
Yeah.
You were more one of the boys.
Yeah, I was more one of the boys, and I was I liked the camaraderie of it, and I liked the challenge of it. Like, I played for the Gaels, and I played for Dundalk Rugby Club, did quite well there. But those, you know, when you're running up and down a pitch on the side of a hill on a Tuesday night and it's peeing rain, you're kind of going, why the hell am I doing this? It was later on in life when I started going to pubs and clubs, the two of those things weren't really conducive. But from when I was younger, I was always outdoors, always playing football.
What was your, did you go to dances and things? What year are we talking about now?
Well, if you want to, well, like my earliest memories was when I went to the Redeemer School. But when I left the Redeemer School, maybe when I was 11 or 12, we moved house. We moved house to Green Acres. Villa Park and Green Acres, and that's when I started going to discos and things like that.
And where did you go?
That was in St. Gerard's Hall. So I love St. Gerard's Hall, Harry. It was, I know looking back, it was probably a ramshackle kind of dank hall when I was going there. It was probably 100 years old when I was there. But we used to bring our record players down every Friday night, when I think of it, in the back of somebody's car, and we'd go in and play records in the hall. And there were girls there and people mixed and all that type of stuff. So that was the start
of me. And
did
you get on well with girls?
I did, yeah.
Were you confident with them?
I was confident with them. But you see, because I wasn't very big in stature, early on in life, I figured out if you were quick talker, you could get yourself in and out of any bit of trouble.
And you've been doing it ever since.
Exactly. Without having to swing your fists. And it's a great thing in life that if you can talk your way in and out of something.
What's that got to do with girls?
Oh, well, I could make progress with girls by talking to them, you know. But girls, I wasn't one of these super cool, suave guys that had the right clothes and all that. Because when we were growing up, Harry, like, I'd never considered us to be a rich family. We weren't poor, but we weren't rich. So we didn't always have the latest runner boots or the latest jeans. Other people had, but I didn't remember having them. But we
did you think that you had money, or did money not come into it at all in your mind in your teenage years?
I would say that when I moved into my teenage years, I started having an appreciation for money when I started working in the pub in the Avenue Inn.
At what age?
At about 12.
You'd never get away with it now.
No, I looking back on it now, and I have a son who's 12 now. It's the furthest thing from my mind. It's one of those bittersweet issues that you
and
have
in
your life.
How did you get in there?
My mother got me a job collecting glasses. So that's how it started. And it was a once-off, and then it turned into, tell them to come back next weekend and stuff like that. And that was a hell of an introduction into life. It certainly formed me for the person that I am.
Were you conscious of what was happening within the pub, even at that early age?
Not immediately. I have to say I was quite innocent growing up. And I have my parents to thank for that. They shielded me to a lot of things in life. You know, I never, you know, if something bad came on the TV, my parents would turn it off. You know, or if there was some headline in the newspaper, I pushed that newspaper away. Or if there was a debt in the family or something like that, we were kind of shielded from that.
But how many was in your family?
There were two sisters, Grania and Melissa. So, I had two sisters, mom and dad. And then, you know, we were just an average family but I was the oldest. So I was the one who made all the mistakes, you know, from how late you can stay out at night and if you throw stones, you know, were you seen doing that? So, you know, I never got in trouble with the guards or anything like that. But back to your question about working in the pub. Initially when I went in there, I was quite naive. I didn't know all the vices that there are in life, and I didn't know the complexity of people, that people would lie and cheat, because I wasn't used to that in my family.
True drink, you mean?
True drink. Lie and cheat. And then I remember I had been working as a lounge boy in the Avenue Inn. You haven't been in pubs, Harry, but what you used to do was you had a white shirt and a dicky bow, when I think back to it, and a pair of black slacks. That was your uniform. And I had worked as a lounge boy, collecting glasses and taking orders and all that type of stuff for years. And then I was promoted to be a barman. And that was an eye-opener and a half, because I didn't realise there was such a thing as the early shift and the late shift. Do you know what that is?
I would imagine, yeah. You would walk in the afternoon from where it opened.
No, I'm talking about drinkers.
Oh, drinkers. Yeah. Oh, sorry, I beg your pardon.
Yeah,
go
so
on.
I didn't realise that the men that I saw coming in with their wives in the evenings had already been in the pub earlier on that day.
So that's what you call the second shift.
That's what you call the early shift and the late shift. So that was an eye-opener to me. I was going, holy Jesus, these guys are drinking during the day and at night time. But I saw, you know, as I became more aware, I saw the unpleasant, nasty side of life in a pub. You get everything. Like, most of these people are just hard-working people who wanted something to do at the weekend. Like, my parents went to the pub four nights a week because everybody else did it. That's how it was done. That's how they socialized. That's how they let off steam. That's how it was done. But I saw the unpleasant sides of life. But what it also taught me personally was there's money to be made here if you want to make it. So I started to have more money than other people of my age because I was working. So I didn't ask my parents for pocket money after a certain age. I was just going, no, I'll learn it myself. And then I started to, you know, get a few quid together. And then there was a point in my life when I kind of just always had a bit of money. It wasn't that I never had money. I was working at the weekends and I always had a few quid.
Which was good.
It taught me that kind of self-reliance. Mm. I'll tell you what I really appreciated, Harry. At times like Christmas and birthdays, I could buy people stuff. You know, I had a few quid there to be able to buy stuff. And if I wanted to save for something, I could. It wasn't I had a credit union book. I didn't hoard it. I got it and I spent it.
And that was a very rare thing for of your age to have a credit union.
My folks started the three of us off on a credit union book, and I put a few quid into a credit union book and just tipped away at it. But, you know, later on in life, I started buying clothes and I enjoyed buying better clothes.
Let's just move on to another big part of your life. How did you meet Kim?
How did I meet Kim?
Yeah.
Well, you're jumping way forward now.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So how I met Kim was a friend of a friend of mine. And I had known Kim for a long time in the circle of friends that had kind of come and gone. Right from my 20s, right through to my 30s. So she'd always kind of been there.
You knew her for 10 years before you went out with her?
Yeah, I did, yeah. Yeah.
You're a slow starter. No. And you say you're talking, but God, you didn't talk much.
No, yeah. Different people came and went in those 10 years, so better be careful what way I say this. Yeah, different people came and went in her life and my life. And then there just came a time when we saw more of each other and popped the question. That was it.
And when did you get married? What year did you get married?
2005. Got married in 2005. I was 34, I think. Yeah. And I felt it was a time in my life that I had a lot of things were felt right. And getting married felt right. And I was with the right person. And thank God I'm still with the right person. And it felt right to me. And funny enough, I'd lost my job in the brewery, which was a very big part of my life.
Yeah, that's where I was going to come back to. Where I was you just come in too quick there for me. How did you get into McArdle-Mearsbury? Because in McArdle-Mearsbury, as far as I was concerned, you had to have your mother or your father or somebody walking in it to get in.
People say that all the time, that you have to have a relative.
And it is true, isn't it, Jason? Not with you.
In my case, I didn't realise that before I went to the brewery. How I got into the brewery was a complete accident. I was doing work experience from a course up in Ophi College, and you had to do 2 weeks work experience. And I went to do my first week in a place called TSM on the Echo Road. And I went in there and I didn't like it. There was nothing wrong with the company. It was the job that they'd asked me to do was designing, like an engineering designing job. And I couldn't really do that from what I'd learned. And I went back to Davy McDonald, who was the guy who was coordinating the course, and I said, Davy, this isn't really suiting me. Is there anything else? He says, yeah, something came in today from McCardle's. They're looking for somebody. So it was completely accidental. And so I got a week's work experience there, and I loved it. And 8 years later, I was working full blast.
There's very few people didn't like walking up in McCardle Mirrors, isn't
it? Yeah. It was, having looked back on it, it was the best job I ever had. Apart from the job I'm doing now, which is working for myself. It spoilt me a little bit in my expectations of what future jobs would be like. I can't really explain it to anybody, but there is a sense of loyalty that has stayed with me all my life because of it. Now, it was a beer, and I drank beer, so that was always a plus. It was extremely well paid, and there were lots and lots of benefits from there. So medical, training, even just the networking opportunities that were there.
But there was absolutely no other job working in any kind of factory or anything like that had all of the good things that McCardle Mirrors had for
the workers. The problem with that, Harry, was I never really knew that until, like, I never chose that as a place that I wanted to work. Funny enough, there were about five people who lived in Green Acres that their fathers worked in the brewery. And we kind of knew they were well paid and we'd heard about the brewery, but nobody had ever said to me, do you know what? You should look and go and get a job in the brewery. That'll be a good job. Because all along when I was going through school, I was heading on a journalism path. I was always kind of good at English and I can write fairly well. And I can still do it. I can re-edit stuff and in a way that comes across in the journalism. I just didn't get the points. But nobody had said, there is a company in Dundalk, which is the best company in Dundalk for lots of reasons. You should go for that. And it was when I was in it, maybe a year or two, other people were saying to me, you don't realise how lucky you are. And I said, no, I do.
No, we have to keep going. We could take about 10 hours out of this, but we have to keep going a bit. What kind of change in your life did you having Oisin and Eve, your two children?
It was a massive change. It was a massive change for me, and one I really wasn't ready for. I don't know if I'd ever consciously sat down and said, okay, by a certain age, I want to have kids. I don't think any man does. I think it's a more of a maternal thing. And it was just the next phase of my life. But when the kids came along, it knocked me for about 10 years. The demands that having kids have on your life was huge. And I wasn't ready for them, really. Plus, when Oisin came along, Kim wasn't well for a little while, and just the responsibility of that. And I'm one of these people who takes responsibility very seriously. You know, if someone gives me something to do, I see it through all the way to the end. So I suddenly had this new life that I went, oh my God, I'm responsible for everything here. So from somebody who used to like to go to the pub and lie in on a Sunday morning and all that type of stuff, that changed immediately. And my lifestyle changed hugely. And I kind of lost contact with a lot of my friends, which is not that unusual, in the same ways as I used to, for a long while. And that's only starting to come back now, really. But all in all, the kids are an absolute joy and they're the meaning for your life. Now, you can't really explain that to anybody else, you know, that you have all these moments of happiness and, you know, laughter and little things. And thankfully, they came along in the phone age. So I have all those videos and we have thousands of pictures of them. So the kids will come up to us every now and again and say, Dad, will you show us a couple of photos of when we were kids? And we're able to do it.
Which we... You can't. I'm the complete opposite.
Yeah, you can't.
We haven't got one photograph of any of the kids.
You probably have better memories though, Harry. Like when I take a photo of a video, it's kind of detached. I kind of go, right.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. Mm. Yeah, and a memory is probably better.
Yeah, maybe last better. Seen, yeah. Somebody will say to me, do you remember? I'll go, let me check my phone now and see if I can figure it out.
Would you call yourself, I would call you a very open father with your children, like which we in my age group weren't.
Yeah. You know? I would say I was, and it was a deliberate act. I deliberately wanted to talk to the kids in such a way that everything was open. And it's always been like that with the kids. Come and talk to us. Come and ask us. So we've gone through the whole birds and bees conversation just recently, especially with Oisin, who's older. And he asked me some toe-curling questions. And I give him absolutely honest, straight answers. And these questions come at any time. So you could be driving the car and he'll say, oh, Dad, I heard this thing. My friends were talking about this thing in school the other day. What's that? And you just have to tell him what it is. There's no sense of, oh, ask your mother, or I'm not going to tell you that, because I don't see any benefit of that. You know, I want the kids to be at any stage of their life to be able to ask us things and we answer them kind of like adults, you know, kind of in an open way.
I think it's a wonderful thing to have done, because in when we were growing up, it was all behind a school shed.
Yeah.
And you hadn't a clue.
No.
You know, I probably still haven't a clue at half of the things.
Well, you had a few kids, Harry, so you worked it out somewhere along the line.
But where did you live when you got married first, Jason?
Lived in Lennonstown Green.
In where?
Lennonstown.
Is that down the point? Or
yeah, kind of down the point road. Yeah.
All right.
The okay. Red Barns Road.
Red Barns Road. Yeah.
I had a... That was the best part of my life so far, Harry, was living down there. So the sequence in which it happened was I was about 27, so I'll go back a little bit. I was about 27 or 8 when I started to look at buying a house. I was working in the brewery. I was earning good money. I had a few quid saved. And I said, right, I'll go and look at buying a house. And one of my friends was an auctioneer. I tend to be quite impulsive on big purchases. Like when I bought my company van, my car stopped working that day and I walked into Lynn's garage and said, I need a new van.
Rather than think about rather than think other about things it. You would think yeah, about.
It's
maybe
funny
smaller
enough,
things.
Smaller things. Yeah. I go, like this office that we're in here, I walked in and said, yeah, I want a home office and I'll buy it. So I kind of am... I'm a forward thinker a lot, and it's a curse because it tends to make you worry about stuff, but it's a help because you're already planning two or three steps ahead. So, I lived in Lennonstown on my own. I had an absolutely brilliant time there. They used to call it Club McGee because it was like a disco at the weekends. People would come out of Ridley's and go to my house and we would party all night and do it all again the next weekend. It was a great time.
If I took Eve and Oisin in here,
yeah,
how would they describe you?
Oh, that's a good question. Maybe we should bring them in and ask them. No, they always describe me as the easier parent, you know. Describe me as, you know, and you get that. Oh, you get that in marriages, you know. You know, one's a bit harder than the other. So Kim would always be seen as the one laying down the law, and I'd always...
Yeah. And the strange thing was, it was the complete opposite in my house. It was me that yeah. would be
well,
the
you
one.
Can't, I don't yeah. think it's fair to have two people who are laying down the law, because then it's just too much tension all the time, you know? And they would say I'm fairly easygoing. They would say I'm probably always doing something. They would say I'm probably a hard worker, because I'm always working somewhere, doing something. I'd say they'd probably say I'm the easier one. Easier to.
Would you say that you're a popular man?
Well, I know one thing. I'm not as popular as you. Because I learned a lesson walking down Cambassa Street with you one day, is that you can't walk 50 yards without 10 people stopping you. Well, thankfully... Well, that's the only one thing about COVID now. That's not going to happen. But I am well known, probably going back to the sports thing, Harry. That has stood to me all my life. The amount of people that you meet, through organizations. Well, maybe that's a better way of describing it. I was and I am involved in a lot of things. So when, you know, every football team I ever played for, I know all them people. I was at college, I know all them people. School, I remember all those clubs, different things. So you build up a very big group of friends. I don't know if that's the same as being popular, but I'm well known.
Well, popular to me is like you were saying there, but it was only because I was on the radio that people knew
I'd say it's a bit more than that. Go on.
An awful lot of the things that you were saying, I was the same when I was growing up, you know, very, very similar to them, you know. Now, we have to just move on. You then did a job in between, or you might have done a wee bits and pieces, but it was a big part of your life for 3 or 4 years. But it wasn't a happy time for you, and only recently you have changed your whole life around. Tell us a little bit about the job in Dublin.
Oh, right. Okay. So during the recession, things went bad for my company, as they did for anybody's company. So I'm an IT consultant. So I go in and help businesses with computer systems. And the web design game that I was in and I'm still in went completely dry. So in the middle of a recession, the last thing somebody thinks they need is a website. It's actually the first thing they do need to make sales, but it's like painting the front of your shop. It's the last thing you think of. And so what I ended up doing was I looked online for a temporary consultancy role in Dublin, and the one that came up was Fáilte, Ireland. Now, I didn't know anything about Fáilte, Ireland. I kind of had an interest in tourism, but I didn't really know that anything formally about it. So I took up the job with Fáilte, and I really liked it. I found it very interesting. And it's very interesting to get an insight into an organisation like that that's quite famous in Ireland. Everybody knows Fáilte.
Yeah, it's great to say you're
it's
working for
It's a nice one to have
Fáilte
on the CV.
Yeah,
and the gang up there that I was working with, great group of people, and I then got sucked into it and worked there for... I had originally planned to work for 6 weeks, and I did it for 4 years. But the problem was the travel. Over time, it grinded my gears down, and I became much more unhappy with doing it, which kind of made the job unhappy. So you can't differentiate between the two. So, for instance, we're getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning. You go, you get the bus, the Matthews coach. Freezing cold mornings like this morning. You sit in the bus, you go all the way up. Nobody really talks to anybody on the bus. It's a kind of soulless, lifeless thing. Now, I used to listen to the radio a lot because I'm into news the same way as you are. And I'd have a lot of facts and figures and stories of the day by the time I got off the bus. Then I'd do the job. I was in a role that was quite high pressure. To be able to put, there was a lot of change going on, and change is very high pressure. And I was putting a lot of pressure myself. Then I was coming home at night, getting off the bus at 6:30. Coming home maybe, if I was lucky, at 7 o'clock. Sometimes the buses were late. See the kids, have a bit of dinner, and probably be in bed by 8:30. So that lifestyle eventually shattered your entire life. Now, it was good money, and that was the reason I was doing it. But there came a point when I went, no, I can't do this anymore. I just can't do it. And my contract was coming up to its end, and circumstances presented themselves to say...
Because it was a big decision to decide.
It's a very big decision. People think, are you crazy? Are you crazy giving up a contract in a company like that for substantial money that you won't get in Dundalk? Are you crazy? And I went, no. I was looking around the bus, Harry, and I was going, I am one of the older people on this bus, and I'm only 48. So I was looking around going, there are younger people here doing this, and they've got the energy to do it, and maybe not got the responsibilities that I have. But I just went, no. And one other thing happened was this home office. So about 7 months before I finished, I made the decision, I'm going to get that home office in the garden. I wasn't even going to be in it for 7 months. And I think that was something subconscious in my head that said, get yourself into, get that, and the other bits of the jigsaw will come in line. There's a book called The Secret. Kim has it, and a lot of people have it. And the theory goes, if you want to get a Ferrari, buy the Ferrari keyring first, and then the other bits will come.
Well, where we are now has turned into an absolutely lovely little studio that anyone would give their eye to be going to work in it.
Absolutely. And as it turned out you might call it lucky. You might call it, when the pandemic came and everybody started working from home, that absolutely suited me down to the ground, because I was, the timing was right, what I had here was right. And then suddenly everybody needed websites, so all of those things conspired to come together. Mm. Maybe it was luck, maybe it was foresight, I don't know.
Now, changing back a part of when we got involved, I was working with Dundalk FM and I left them in 2010.
Yeah.
And I was kind of friendly with you. You used to go down and talk to them in Dundalk FM about laptop or websites
and
stuff.
Yeah, and I'd pop into you for an interview every now and again.
And so we started then, you and I got together and we were talking about trying to do
radio
for me at that time, and we came up with the idea of Loud Internet Radio, which was just a wonderful idea. Unfortunately we couldn't get funding. We tried so hard, but the year that we were
doing it
for, that was wonderful, and we did some wonderful stuff in it.
We were ahead of our time from that point of view, because internet radio 10 years ago was only in its infancy, really. It was only kind of one of these things you have on the side. Now it's mainstream. Now there are whole radio stations who are just on the internet and are not anywhere else. But I remember, and I will always appreciate that Conor Hughes gave us that office for the best part of a year. I don't think we ever paid him a penny in rent. And we bought some equipment off him and he helped us out. But it was a beautiful view overlooking Blackrock Strand, and we must have been crazy to think that, you know, we could pull this off. But it started like it started with any dream, you know, two people with just a good idea. Then other people came on board, and I think we had about a dozen people with us at one point.
And every one of them were wonderful.
Every one of them were wonderful. Yeah. All volunteering. We were getting our branding together and all that type of stuff. And it was a great location. And then naturally, any business, you have to have a funding stream or it doesn't.
Yeah, because I think Kieran, who was wonderful too, Kieran Hughes, came along as the producer, shall we say.
Yeah.
I did all the talking and Kieran was absolutely wonderful chap. And we were very, very lucky to have him for the full year.
Yeah, we were very lucky to have them all. And I remember we had a great Christmas party at the end of it, Harry, and we're still friendly with all those people. And then we restarted up again. A few years ago, wasn't quite the same, but it just showed us that we could do it and we could pull it together. But it does give you an insight into how cutthroat, you know, being in the media industry is from point of view of making money. It's very hard to do.
Now, our next venture, we talked an awful lot about different things over the years, didn't we? But our next thing was, without any shadow of a doubt, was in 2013 for the gathering year. And we came up with this idea of interviewing people coming home from on the holidays during that year.
Yeah, the Gathering Heritage Project. You and I have a grow for all good stories and people, and it seemed to make sense that was people coming back to Ireland who had been away for ages, and they would have interesting stories. There's a story in there in everybody, but whether you can get it out of them or not, that's part of your talent. You can get them out. And I was doing the technical bit to be able to record it. But yeah, we did. We interviewed an awful lot of people. Some of them were quiet and then told very personal stories. Others had really interesting, you know, public famous lives. And I'm really happy that we still have that archive of material. And right up until this month, we've still been adding stuff to it. So
Yeah, and the for the gathering year, we did a couple of interviews with people who were not away, but they were well-known Dundalk people who had gone away and came back at different times, like Jim Carr, or the wonderful interview that we did with the chairman,
director general,
Savage, Tom Savage.
Tom Savage.
And Tom has died. Zoe Conway's grandfather, wonderful interview. Yeah. He has died.
Yeah.
And they will all, in years to come, hopefully, all of that stuff that we did will be looked upon, and hopefully that people will listen to some of the good.
That was one of the reasons for doing it, you know. There were a couple of ones that I really wanted. The one that we did with Noel Sharkey about the Mary Stoddart disaster, I'm delighted we got that. That is that's a very interesting story that may not be that well known, but now we have it. And the other delightful one that we got recently was Paddy Madole. Paddy is
the recent one.
Is the second most famous person in Dundalk after you. And we got Paddy's one, and Paddy's little interview and little story was listened to thousands and thousands of times. So everybody has a story. We are just lucky enough to be able to capture some of them.
I was talking to Paddy the other day, and he was so pleased that people were listening to him, you know. Yeah. And we have a couple of wee ideas that we'll come up with later on, and Paddy will be involved in one of them if it all comes back. What is the future now for you, Jason? Your business, thank God, is going very well, because it's particularly now in the pandemic and everything.
Yeah.
The websites are, everybody has to have a website nearly now.
Well, I suppose as you get older, you're looking to say, okay, what's my plans for the future? And I heard a very interesting thing on the radio not so long ago to say that most people's lives are in a U-shaped curve for happiness, and the bottom part is in your 40s. They say you're most unhappy in your 40s, and the reason is you've got all the responsibilities, like you've kids and you've a mortgage that's very heavy. But as you start to head out of that, you will be getting happier, and I feel that now. I can feel that sense of more time to myself. I'd like to travel a bit more, Kim. You know, I traveled a lot in my 20s. I think I had visited 24 countries out of 27 by the time I was 30. I'd like to travel a bit more. Myself and Kim went on a cruise for a honeymoon, and it was fantastic, and I'd love to do it again. I'd like to go. I never really was somebody who went to concerts and gigs, outdoor stuff. I maybe should start doing a bit more of that. I hope to be working a bit less and enjoying stuff a bit more with the kids and the family, Harry. I'm conscious that it's a very easy trap to fall into, to be working all the time when you're working for yourself.
We're living in, this is the terrible pandemic at the moment, and the virus, and then there's a stronger virus coming.
Yeah.
And you said to me that you wanted to do this, particularly for your children when they grow up. And they have their own children to listen to what you had to say about growing up, you know. It's been a very, very tough year, Jason.
It has, Harry, but I was lucky in that I had a safe place to operate from and think. I was able to, when everybody was sitting watching Judge Judy, I was in here thinking about, I was working because it was an opportunity to work at, but I do think this whole year has given everybody a pause for thought. I think even the likes of Christmas gifts that people are buying each other, there is a sense of, we're spending money on a load of crap here before, let's buy somebody something that means something to them. I think there is a sense of that going on there. The reason I wanted to do this interview was people are dying. People are dying, that they're dying before their times. And I was maybe 2% worried that I would die and I would never have got this interview down. So, you know, I think it's something that I felt I just wanted to do. In case something happened to me, I've had friends that have died before their time and it had a terrible effect on me. And there's so many what ifs. I think it's important, especially when you have kids, to lay down some of your legacy and some of your thoughts. Because after all, when do you ever get the chance to relay your life story? Most people run through their whole lives and they never pause to think about what their life has been, what the highlights are, the lowlights are. Nobody ever really asks them, and they certainly don't record it. So I'm delighted to have recorded this now. And I am actually cognizant that the one interview that got away from us was the one from Lord Ballyedmond, Haughey, who was all set up to do our interview and died in a helicopter crash. So he didn't see that coming. Nobody knows what's around the corner. But I do think next year, I think maybe we will be into March and April. You know, I don't think we'll be as far down the line as we all think we might be. But the vaccines will be rolled out. But certainly by the end of next year, I think things will come back with a boom. Because they did in the 1920s after the last pandemic. There was a whole stack of pent-up frustration and money that's in Ireland right now. And that I think people will want to party a little bit. And hopefully that's just around the corner.
I would think that, and I'm not quite sure whether I would like it or not, I don't know, to have done a recording with my own father. And but naturally, it was long before the radio.
Yeah.
But thinking what you were just saying there now, I don't know whether I would like to hear his voice. I'm not quite sure whether it. I just don't know.
Right.
But I, on the other hand, I do regret that we know absolutely very little about my father, and even less about my real mother.
Yeah.
As you know, she died when we were very, very young. So I think what you're doing is. This is. We better just say what year this is.
Yeah.
This is 2020.
Yeah.
Christmas. Yeah. We're just the day before Christmas Eve. And what this year, Jason, in comparison to other years, do you feel about Christmas?
Oh, that's a good question, Harry. That's a good question. I don't feel very Christmassy right now. Kim, God bless her, gets into Christmas mode the day after Halloween. So she's full Christmassy mode. But the more and more of these restrictions that are kicking in, the more of the things that you enjoy at Christmas are being taken from us. For instance, Christmas Eve, people like to go to a restaurant or a bar. We can't do that. Even out here in Black Rock, Connor Hughes's traditional St. Stephen's Day activities probably won't go ahead. So I think what's going to happen this year, Harry, is that we're going to get closer and closer to Christmas and not actually feel it's like Christmas until the day. And then when it's over, we'll kind of go, is that it? You know, because that's the difference I'm feeling this year. I don't feel there is, when you go downtown, there isn't the same buzz. There isn't the same, you know, everybody's got the mask on. They just want to get in and get out and get home. There isn't that moment for pause or chat. But Harry, please God, it's just this year and that's it.
Now, you have, you love football too.
I do,
the international team and everything like that. And you've travelled quite a bit to different games with Dundalk and everything like that. But another peculiar kind of pastime you have is only fools and horses.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that.
I don't know. I can't explain it, Harry. I have watched Only Fools and Horses all my life. And I have really, really tried to figure out what it is about. Apart from the humour, apart from the, like when you think of it, somebody in Dundalk has nothing in common with somebody from South London. Even the phrases that they use, and I've Googled them all, you know, some of the Cockney slang and all that to look up what they were. They have nothing in common. The only thing I think I've in common is I am a bit of a Del Boy type of character. And I've read David Jason's autobiography. And he is a very private guy, but he got a couple of lucky breaks in life. And he's a very optimistic type of individual, but the Del Boy character I really warmed to, because he, at the end of one of the series, I forget which one it was, when he won the millions, said, "It was not like I thought it was going to be. It was all in the chase." And I'm a bit like that. It's all in the chase. We'll try this idea. We'll try this project. We'll try this app. We'll do this thing. It's not in actually achieving it. It's all in the chase. So what I'm probably saying is, if I won a million, Harry, it'd ruin me.
No, I bought Jason as a present this year a quiz book on only fools and horses.
Right.
Okay,
talking to the mic there now. Harry,
you have not seen the book.
No,
it's only now that I'm opening the book.
Yeah,
and I'm just going to see. You said that you could probably go on Mastermind and walk away with it.
No, I didn't.
I
said if I go on Mastermind, my specialist subject would be only fools and horses, and that's not quite the same as saying and walk away with it. But we're about to see.
Now, I'm just going to open it at a page. Now, will we see what we'll open it at? Yep, let's go for this one. At the beginning of the episode, Del Boy was attempting to sell an authentic French nylon. What was he selling?
At the beginning of the episode, Del was attempting to...
At the beginning of the episode, Del Boy was attempting to sell authentic French nylon.
Yeah.
What was he selling?
Tights. Must be tights.
You said...
it could be tights, but it depends on what that question means. What was he selling later on in the episode? But he used the quotes that says... these are run-proof and fun-proof, worn by Charles Aznavour's wife. That's what he says. So they're tights.
And you got it right.
Yeah.
Now, that is, that's before we started this interview, we were just making sure that we knew how to walk the book.
Yeah.
And that's, I asked you two questions then, and you got them too right.
Yeah.
And now this is the third one. Yeah. That you should have great fun with that.
That's a very thoughtful, great gift, Harry.
With the kids, you know.
Yeah.
And Jason, all I can say is that you've been a very, very good friend to me, away from all of the recordings. I think we've done absolutely wonderful stuff that we, not us will be remembered, but people, I hope, will appreciate, particularly the Gathering Heritage website. Mm. And we've an awful lot more to come. We're not finished by it.
As Del Boy says, this time next year, we'll be millionaires.
Jason, thank you very much indeed for talking to me.
My pleasure, Harry. Thank you.
Listen to lots more epic interviews at gatheringheritage.com.